Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Shira Cohn, and we've got a really exciting show for you today. I'm here with Sarah Abravaya-Stein, professor and Maurice Amato Endowed Chair in Sephardic Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. She's joining me to discuss her new book, Extraterritorial Dreams, European Citizenship, Sephardi Jews, and the Ottoman 20th Century, published in 2016 by Chicago University Press. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you so much.
I'm really excited to have you here today.
And I'm excited to talk to you.
Wonderful. So let's get right into it. My first question is really what initially drew you to this topic and how does it fit into the larger themes that you discuss in your general scholarship?
Well, this is a topic that unfolded for me over many, many years of research into the history of Sephardic Jewry and Jews of the wider Mediterranean and Middle East. And I say that because it's a topic, if you went out to search for it, it would be difficult to pursue adequately because it seeps through the history of almost every place in the Mediterranean and Middle East where Jews resided or through which they moved and extended outwards to all the many emigre and diaspora settings in which they lived. What I mean, I think, will become a little more apparent as our conversation continues. But for the moment, what I would say is I began to notice that almost every archive I visited in the course of my research as a professional historian, whether it was a private collection or a government archive or a foreign ministry archive or a community archive, I kept stumbling over documents about this rather ubiquitous and also little understood legal reality of people who lived with papers of a country in which they never lived or never had intention to live in. And so the process was that I began collecting and amassing, and it took me many, many years to begin to connect dots between stories that even while, as I said a minute ago, they were ubiquitous in a way, their connective tissue was still opaque to me until I really began to take the project seriously.
And you call this, shall we say, population or cohort of individuals legal misfits. And I wonder if you can tell me what you mean by legal misfits and really a bit more about what the protégé system is.
Sure. Well, I would start by saying that the field of Jewish history, for the most part, has been organized, the field of modern Jewish history, has been organized in the way that modern historians of other fields tend to organize themselves. Not always, but tend to organize themselves. And that is along national lines. So for the field as a whole, it is more typical for a scholar to focus on German Jewry or on Russian Jewry or on Polish Jewry and so on and so forth. Now, this is shifting with time. There are more people like myself who are engaged in comparative work or transnational work or global histories. But the reason I call them legal misfits, the folks that I'm talking about in this book, and I'll come back in a minute to the question about what the protégé status actually meant, is that they defy the categories both that historians have applied to modern Jewish history and also the categories that we tend to think of as associated with the shaping of modern law and of citizenship. And that is that citizenship is something that you have or you don't have. And especially in the field of Jewish studies, it's something I talk about in the book. It tends to be assumed that the course of modern Jewish history can be explained politically and legally in terms of whether an individual, and usually we're speaking here for the period under, that I'm exploring about men, but women are also a large part of my story. It's assumed that you either are a citizen or you're a subject, maybe of an empire or a colony. And here I was stumbling repeatedly over people who were neither. They didn't fit into the categories that scholars of citizenship law tend to associate with modern citizenry. They also don't fit into the categories that we tend to associate, legally speaking, with modern Jews. So all of that begs the question of what is a protégé? And there isn't a single answer. In a sense, what this book is about is in thinking about a very, very dense category that at the time, the period that I'm exploring, many people who had the authority to grant or deny individual Jewish women and men legal status, they themselves didn't always understand the terms of legal categorization that they had the authority to offer. So that is a bit ambiguous, and I can try and make it a bit concrete if you'll let me delve a little bit into the Ottoman context.
Actually is my next question. This really set the stage Ottoman 20th century, as you say.
Right. Well, so I both have been talking about it as an abstraction, and you're right to focus on that term legal misfits, because I'm interested in people who defy what we think to be the logic of modern citizenship law. But more specifically, what I'm interested in are Jews who were born in the Ottoman Empire or who were descended from the Ottoman Empire, who, according to a series of laws that English-speaking readers might know as the capitulatory regime, a series of laws that stretched back to the 16th century and were signed between the Ottoman authorities and the European authorities. These laws granted a degree of autonomy to non-Ottoman subjects who lived or worked or passed through the Ottoman Empire, and conversely, that granted Ottoman subjects who lived or worked in or passed through the European territories, granted them a degree of legal autonomy and protection from things like fees and tolls and fines and potentially military conscription. Now, those who lived in the Ottoman Empire who were granted this status of being so-called protégés, that's the way the French talked about it. The British used the word British protected persons, but both of those terms actually have their own complicated history I won't digress into now. But those people who held the protégé status were originally meant to be Christians and Jews. And at the very beginning of the 16th century, they were mostly Christians. But over time, the number of Jews who acquired or who sought the protégé status grew and grew. And it's a sort of small tributary of the project. But one of the things I talk about is that even this idea that it was only non-Muslims who could become protégés blew up in the 19th and 20th century, if not earlier. And a Jew could acquire the protégé status and convert to Islam, becoming a Muslim protégé, even though no such thing ever was meant to exist. So it's a very complicated landscape, but I am talking really about what I call in the book an early modern legal order that is inherited in the modern period. And everything we've said right now has been on something of a realm of abstraction, but it's actually a very concrete condition for Jewish women and men. It means that, for example, you might be a Jew living in the great Jewish Sephardic cultural capital of Salonika, present-day Thessaloniki, Greece, and you might have grown up there, and your parents might have grown up there, and your grandparents might have grown up there. You might have been there for five generations, but you would still hold Italian papers based on a longer historical and familial trajectory. And if you held these papers, it could make the difference between life and death in the course of the 20th century. And the book is really focused not on the long history of the protégé system, but what happens, as I describe in the book, when the protégé system bumps against a modern passport regime. And what happens when the assumption of states and also of individuals and certainly local consular agents and people empowered with the right to approve or deny your legal status. What happens when this fuzzy early modern legal order bumps up against a modern nationalizing world? And what does it mean for women and men and children and families who carry papers or lose their status or seek to renew their status, or their status expires, or their papers are burned, or in questions of inheritance and death and crime? What actually happens to people when very abstract and complex legal categories are tested?
So let me ask you something. What What is the impetus for, especially in this modern period, European nations to grant these papers, especially to Sephardi Jews? What's sort of, you know, in it for them, shall we say?
Right.
And why
That's
are Jews
question.
Going to seek out European papers if they're subjects of the or citizens of the Ottoman Empire?
That's a fantastic question. And unfortunately, it too has no single answer. what I've learned is that the fact that there isn't a single answer is really important. We might think that the answer would exist in a foreign ministry directive or in national legal codes. But actually, this was felt out on the ground in the course of human interactions between the many, many layers of people who represented states and the many kinds of Jews who thought about becoming protégés or inherited the protégé status or acquired it and perhaps it threatened to lose it. These were not cut and dry legal entities. Now, what might make the protégé status appealing for a nation? It might be that a country wanted to cultivate a collection of merchants in a given city who would funnel their taxes to the home nation, let's say Britain, rather than to the local authority. So there's a financial motive, one. The second possibility is currying influence. There was an idea, which I think turns out to be more of a fantastical idea than a solid one, but there was the idea that if you gave these papers, you would be acquiring a kind of local lobbying force who would represent your interests. As we all know very well from contemporary politics, that, you know, you can never really rely on the persistent and undying and unwavering loyalty of people who you might claim to represent. So the other thing I would say, the third point I would just say is that a state's interest would ebb and flow with the course of history. So maybe to move from the abstract to the very concrete, one of the chapters in the book is about how in the course of the first Balkan Wars that take place just on the eve of and bleeding into the First World War, in the course of the first Balkan Wars, various nations descend on the city of Salonika, which has the largest Sephardic population in the region. It's one of the most important cultural centers for Sephardic Jewry, one of the rare cities in Europe that had a majority Jewish population, and a place where Jews were very important merchants and very important to the overall mercantile economy. But to go back to my story, in the course of this war, a number of nations sort of descend on Salonika, especially Spain, Portugal, and Austro-Hungary. And they begin to essentially throw papers, legal documents, at families who want them. They are seeking to acquire a local citizenry. And they each had their own strategic motives for wanting to do so. So the point is, it can be faddish. The desire for Sephardic subjects can come and go, can be appealing to a state, and then suddenly seem to be dangerous to that very same state. So it's a kind of churning of waters where the desires of individuals can merge with the desires of states, both of which are always shifting.
So would it be fair to say that both locality and fluidity are two words that would be very helpful when thinking about your research?
Absolutely. And I give the title of the book this somewhat whimsical phrase, Extraterritorial Dreams, because I think that one of the things that came through so vividly to me is that there are a lot of fantasies involved. And sometimes fantasies can go horribly wrong. Sometimes a dream can turn into a nightmare, either for a state or for an individual. And these papers can, as I said before, make a difference between life and death. They can bring you success and opportunity. They can also represent constraint and even vulnerability.
I'm wondering about the holders, in some ways, of these papers. And you mentioned earlier that usually when we're talking about the papers, we're talking about men.
Right.
How did gender affect the ways in which individuals or families were granted passports?
So it's really fascinating. And I really wanted this book not to be a history of law in the abstract, but of the way in which individuals experience law. So it's kind of a human level exploration of what citizenship meant for people. Again, no clear system, no clear guidelines. And it really came down to the very local level. A consular agent was usually the one who would inscribe someone's name into a ledger, granting them protection, legal protection. That individual could write down simply a man's name, and the assumption would be that the women and the children, their legal status hinged on that of the patriarch. And yet, some of these consular representatives wrote down the name of women. They gave them their own line. Sometimes they even gave children their own line. And then, and their own number and their own paperwork. So, one of the things I talk about in the book is that if the protégés became legal misfits in the modern period, women really existed on the kind of outermost sphere of legal instability. Because even if you as a woman could acquire the protection of the Italian state or the Spanish state or the Portuguese state, ultimately you weren't a citizen. And that legal status could be taken away. So if you were put on the passport of a husband or a brother and that person dies, you may lose your legal status, even though it's possible you had your own line on the ledger. So I follow in the book the stories of women whose legal status changed over time. Maybe they were an Ottoman subject, then they became a Portuguese subject dependent on their husband or dependent on their father. Then they became a widow. And then the debate opens up. Could that widow keep her papers? Could she still be Portuguese, even though the man, her husband or her father, her brother, who acquired the status for her is no longer legally of that nation?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a complex muddle both for women and for children, and in a sense, by extension, for families too. And what fascinates me about the topic is not so much to say there's a single history that we can rewrite here, a history of Sephardic women becoming protégés, but to say when we look at the protégé system, we see how diverse Jewish experiences can be, that and individual experiences can shift depending on how old you are, or whether you're a woman or a man, or whether you're single or married, or a widow or a widower, and subject, you know, living in a city at war, or as boundaries shift around you, and so on and so forth.
So with that in mind, are these efforts to secure protégé status by Sephardi Jews individual or family endeavors, or was there a stake or a role for Jewish communal organizations? I'm thinking, for example, of the Alliance Israelite
yes.
Universelle.
Right. It could be any of the above. Usually what I find is that individuals or families would go to a consulate to pursue this legal status at one time or together. And so that would mean if you're looking through the ledgers of the Italian consulate in Izmir, say, you would find all of the people's names at the same coming in the same day or the same week or the same month. But it could also be that you would have one family and they would hedge their bets. And let's say they had five sons, each son would go to a different consulate and pursue papers from a different state, so that suddenly the family, without ever having left the place of their birth, becomes multinational. Sometimes there's a wonderful Ladino memoir I talk about in the book, where the author describes how he plays one consulate off of another. He's just trying to see what's the best arrangement for him and his family. So he might go to three different consulates and apply to become a citizen of each nation, simply to see what, you know, as the tides shift, what will be the most secure. And there's really nothing to stop an individual in this historical context from having the papers of more than one foreign state and using them to advantage. So it wasn't, there was no way to kind of cross-check whether somebody was merely or simply or only British or only French or only Spanish.
And because of all these different efforts going on, even within one family, as you say, did any communal agency take a stand on the issue or the other, or did they sort of hands off?
Right. I asked that earlier, and you asked about the Alliance specifically. There were many voices of the fact of the emergence of all of these so-called legal misfits. Again, it's my term. It wouldn't have been used in this time, caused communities, caused legal theorists, caused individuals of a whole variety of political stripes anxiety. So the phenomenon of the Jewish protege was criticized from many, many perspectives. There was a Zionist critique that it represented a betrayal of the notion of the Jewish nation. There was a socialist critique because it was assumed that you had to wield influence and pay a fee, which was true in most cases, to get foreign papers. There was a kind of communitarian response that would say, by getting foreign papers, you're effectively divesting yourself of communal politics, because what you are doing is giving up your right to have a vote as a local citizen. There were nationalist critiques from every context, whether it was, you know, after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, whether it was Bulgaria or Greece or Turkey, or Italy. There was long into the 20th century, there is bitterness about the thought that you might live in a nation and hold papers from somewhere else, again, where you might never have lived and had no intention of living. And I'm sure I've left out more. The Alliance, you mentioned before, was a major French Jewish philanthropy created in the late 19th century that aimed to, in their words, regenerate or uplift Middle Eastern and Mediterranean Jewry. And the vehicle for this in their mind was the creation of schools across the so-called Levant, the Middle East, North Africa, the Mediterranean, and also through the attempt to pressure states to grant citizenship to Jews. So there was an interesting tension that in most cases they felt if Jews could successfully lobby for citizenship, if nations were willing to grant Jews citizenship, the Alliance, like many other Jewish organizations, felt that that would be the crucial force for leveling opportunity and for removing barriers to Jewish social, professional ascension, residential freedoms, and so forth, so on and so forth. So the Alliance didn't have a static policy about the protege status, but in many ways it was anathema to what the organization really stood for, which was it tended for most of its years of existence in this period of the late 19th and early 20th century, it tended to eschew Zionism and support the idea of Jewish integration into national contexts, but by the Frenchification, let's say, and the embourgeoisement of Jewish boys and girls, and ultimately families.
Mm-hmm. To bring up another case study that was in your book, you discuss at length the case of Silas Aaron Hardoon, who was, I believe, Baghdad-born or descended, longtime resident of Shanghai, whose estate, when he died in 1931, was valued at around, I believe, $150 million.
Right, right.
And you say that Hardoon's status as a protege led to a debate, really an international debate, and as well as one between family members about who the estate's beneficiaries should be. How does this relate to the themes in your work?
Okay. Well, it's nice to have the chance to talk about that, because this was actually the case study that for me launched the project. And it was the first bit of writing that I did around this topic of the protege status, and even more generally, the complex legal status that Jews could occupy during the years and decades that Ottoman authority was contracting and yet undetermined post-imperial legal contexts were emerging. That's really a mouthful. But in any case, to get back to Silas Aaron Hardoon, he died in 1931. He was known to be the richest foreigner in Shanghai. As you said, he had this enormous estate. He was born in Baghdad. He had made his way to China by going through India, working for a very important transnational mercantile firm by the name of D. David Sassoon and Company, which was a global operation owned by a Jewish family from Baghdad. It dealt in opium, which was then legal. It dealt in silk. It dealt in cotton. It stretched very widely across South Asia, East Asia, and beyond. So Hardoon makes his way to Shanghai as a young entrepreneur, and he settles there and he lives there for 6 decades, in the course of which he marries a Buddhist woman whose father might have been Jewish. It's not clear. They are very invested in local politics. They are very invested in local Jewish culture. There are a couple of works by scholars of Chinese history that engage in the history of Hardoon from very different angles for people who are interested really in their sort of identity and economic and social roles in the city of Shanghai. But what interested me was the controversy that arises when he dies. When he dies, it's discovered that he had willed his fortune to his wife. And this is quickly challenged by people who claim to be cousins, carrying the name Hardoon, living mostly in Baghdad, but also across the Baghdadi Jewish diaspora in Calcutta and in Shanghai. And they say the money doesn't belong to her. The money belongs to us because he was born in the Ottoman Empire, where the place that he was born is now the state of Iraq. And his estate should be adjudicated according to the law of the place of his birth. And so there is a court case, and the court case takes place in a British Supreme Court in Shanghai. And it asks the question, what was he? Was he, and how should his estate be judged? Should it be judged according to Ottoman law, though the empire doesn't exist? He was a British protected person, so should he be judged by British law? Should the estate be judged by Jewish law? All of these questions come up in the case, or should it be adjudicated by so-called private international law, actually a relatively new legal subdiscipline. So that all sounds, I don't know, nitpicky and legally heady, I guess. But what's interesting as the case goes forward is that it creates a huge controversy and draws the attention of people all over the world, Jews all over the world, who are fascinated by the death of this Buddhist Jew in Shanghai, this wealthy Buddhist British Baghdadi Sephardic Jew. I mean, who wouldn't be tantalized? But it's also a legal question for states, because for the budding state of Iraq, for the British, for other empires like the British Empire, who are in control of territory in the Middle East that was once Ottoman, it is for those states a challenge to their authority. Do the people you are governing belong to you in a legal sense? Does their money belong to you? Who should control the assets? And I think it's especially touchy, and I go into this in the book, it's especially touchy because this is a time when there are many, many subjects of the European powers in the Middle East who are occupying confusing, let's say, unthought through legal statuses, especially colonial subjects, subjects of protectorates and mandate regimes. And it's not entirely clear what the state's obligation to them will be and what their obligation to the state will be. And so it touches a lot of nerves and becomes a cause célèbre that I try and explore from, you know, the various perspectives that were brought to bear in the court case.
And is it okay to do a spoiler alert and tell the audience who wins?
Yes. The spoiler is that his will is honored and the wife inherits the fortune and the claims of the cousins are rejected. And it is determined that the phrase British protected person would be interpreted to be the same as British subject. And this interested me in part because it's very self-serving. There were other moments at the same time that representatives, let's say, of the British Foreign Office looked at other, parentheses, less wealthy British protected persons and said, we're not going to honor our obligation to them. We are not going to view them as citizens. So the conclusion isn't so much that the legal category of the protege and the citizen come to be one, but that influence is everything. And Silas Hardoon, after his own death, in a sense, buys himself citizenship or buys it for his wife and his descendants, because of his influence, because of his power, because of his prestige. And to me, this is interesting because it shows that, you know, legal history, if you write legal history from the top down and you trust the laws as they are written to be transparent, and to be applied equally, then you get a very, very different history of the law than if you look at individual cases and you compare the legal experience of, as this case suggests, an incredibly wealthy emigre versus a poor one.
And in thinking about, you know, you mentioned descendants, I realize this is a very large question, but perhaps there's a case or two that could, you know, sort of encapsulate some of these issues. To what extent is the protege system itself compromised during World War II?
Right. Well, I go into the history of what becomes of the proteges only during the Second World War. At the end of the book, in a conclusion that looks forward, you know, beyond the time period really of the book, which otherwise stops in the 1930s, 1934 or so. And I do so in order to talk about the uneven fate of Jews who were proteges or who had inherited the protege status from ancestors who were born in the Ottoman Empire. And what I describe is that, you know, one might think that because the Nazi regime denaturalized Jews, as did the Vichy regime, one would think that there wouldn't be Jewish legal misfits, that it would be obvious whether you had citizenship or not. One might think that citizenship almost ceased to matter in this context. But as scholars who have studied this will already appreciate, in fact, your legal status could matter a great deal. And if you were a Jew living in France or Greece or elsewhere who had the papers of a neutral nation, you could, although it didn't always mean that you could, but you could, in theory, be exempted from the various deprivations of rights, including deportation to ultimately to the death camps. And there are extraordinary stories of people even being taken off trains, you know, on their way to be transported to the East, who were saved by dint of their legal status. There are also extraordinary stories of rescues of Christian consulates granting foreign papers to Jews, not only in the Sephardic context, but in the Ashkenazi one, in order to give them safe passage to Italy or to Spain or to Portugal. That's one piece of the story that, in theory, if you hold the papers of a neutral nation, your legal autonomy could be preserved and respected. And yet, what happens during the Second World War is that for the Sephardic Jews, and I'm not talking now about the entire spectrum of all the legal ambiguities of the Second World War, but for the Sephardic Jews of Ottoman descent who either have foreign papers or who could identify a close ancestor with foreign papers, there were cases also where the so-called home country, let's pick for the moment Portugal, they might have held Portuguese papers, let's say, granted in Salonika during the Balkan Wars. Portugal didn't choose to honor those papers until the very end of the war, even though there are instances in which Portugal went out of its way, or certain Portuguese representatives, not the state, went out of its way to be liberal in granting passage to Jewish refugees. So just as the whole history of the protege experience is one of muddled legal realities, so too during the Second World War, legal status matters and it can save you. but it doesn't necessarily save you. And in some ways, it makes you vulnerable because you yourself don't know the value of the papers you hold. And so what in the conclusion of the book, I try to briefly sketch out stories both of success and of peril. And in so doing, I'm trying to emphasize that this very, very old by this point, again, early modern legal reality is continuing to shape individual Jews' lives into the 1940s. And the subtitle of the book includes this phrase, the Ottoman 20th century. It's European citizenship, Sephardi Jews, and the Ottoman 20th century. And my point is to say, even after the Ottoman Empire ceases to exist, it bizarrely, unexpectedly, it continues to matter for this population of Jews who occupy this liminal legal world. It continues to matter, you know, right into the 1940s and even longer, in fact, in Egypt. And it matters today, which might be something we want to discuss or not, but it matters today. There are people who still hold the status inherited from this 19th century reality across the Sephardic diaspora. And we have a new chapter today with Spain and Portugal, one might say, pursuing Jews of Iberian ancestry for their own reasons.
Right. Well, let me ask you, because we do have to wrap things up, but I'm curious to know if you've already identified the subject of your next project, and if so, if we can get like a little sneak peek of it.
Sure, with pleasure. Yeah, I had the great luxury of having a fellowship year last year in which I could focus on a new project. And I am working on a book that traces the history of a single family, of single Sephardic family of Ottoman Jewish origin that came from the city of Salonika over the course of some 5-6 generations through migration to many, many countries. And as they maintained connection and intimacy and a sense of being a family, by writing letters and corresponding through the trials and tribulations and successes and losses of everyday life and emigre existence.
Wonderful. I'm really looking forward to reading that.
Thanks. So am I.
Sarah, thanks again for being on the show.
It's been a pleasure.
For everyone, again, please check out Extraterritorial Dreams, European Citizenship, Sephardi Jews, and the Ottoman 20th Century by Sarah Abravaya-Stein, published in 2016 by Chicago University Press. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.